right. When I first saw the title of your report, The Radical Language of Trees, I thought it must be about landscape architecture, but you mean language quite literally. And why is that so surprising? Well, it's only surprising in the context of a capacity for arrogance. It's, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
It's not you. I don't. I'm not responding personally. It's just I'm just so sickened by the years of ridicule, and the level of ignorance and arrogance throughout this story has just been appalling.
Well, maybe we just take a step backward and you can describe what you mean by radical language.
It's radical because this is a phenomena that happens underground. Language because the phenomena is a distinct form of expression that maintains a consistent meaning through time. In short, it is a radical language in the most direct sense. It is language conducted by and through the roots.
So you mean to suggest that tree roots are producing sound?
No, I have never maintained that. That is the misinterpretation that's bandied about by my adversaries. I am not proposing that the roots emit sound, but rather they emit vibrations, and I have developed a special device, a little black box that effectively translates those vibrations into audible sound.
A little black box.
In concept, it is not unlike an early wax cylinder phonograph. It has diaphragm and a stylus. It's sensitive to the pressure of the vibrations. The signal is filtered and compressed and transmitted to the surface through a standard length of aluminum conduit, which I've wired with a contact microphone in order to make the documentary recordings.
I understand you're actually able to provoke response from the trees by playing some kind of clarinet.
Yes, it's an alto clarinet. I don't pretend to play it particularly well, but it does achieve the desired result. Of course, from the standpoint of the trees, it's not the sound of the music that's meaningful, but the vibrations.
And the recordings you sent me in advance, the vibrations sound not dissimilar to whales or elephant mating.
Yes, well, it has been one of my underlying assumptions from the outset of this long research project that the world's great trees have been in active and engaged communication with large mammals for millennia. This is something that might help to explain certain evolutionary advantages enjoyed by those species. Advantages, I should say, that are not satisfactorily explained by some of the competing evolutionary theories.
So large mammals, but what about humans?
Humans as well, though perhaps we've been slower to respond. I've long been impressed in conversation with experienced woodsmen or foresters. They will often talk about being able to sense impending danger around the next bend in the great forest in the bones. And of course, with our superior self-image as a species, we immediately assume that this is some genetically inscribed survival instinct. But it's my contention that what's actually going on here is that the individual is receiving the radical language, that the vibrations are being transmitted through the bones, that the bones are conducting the vibrations as a form of urgent signal of danger or whatever, directly up into the brain.
So that funny feeling in the tummy, those are radical vibrations.
That's right.
Why such benevolent behavior from trees to their most voracious predator?
But the fact is, it's our destructive behavior towards trees that is actually fairly recent, displacing a far more sympathetic relationship that has existed throughout most of time and until quite recently. And this mutuality persists in the customs of many rural communities and indigenous tribes around the world.
So you're not suggesting that trees are inhabited by strange talking spirits or anything like that?
No, at least not in the sense that spirits are producing the actual vibrations, but even that contention would, in my view, be far less ridiculous than the prevailing notion that trees are immutably dumb. There are just so many cultures and individuals around the world who scrupulously attend to the spirits of great trees, and that just makes immaculately perfect sense to me, as does our own practice of returning to trees during times of spiritual need. There's this very well-known passage. I brought some things to read in my briefcase.
Okay.
There's a wonderful passage in the life of Buddha. Therefore, with resolution as his only support and companion, he set his mind on enlightenment and proceeded to the root of a peepal tree where the ground was carpeted with green grass. I never know whether it's peepal or peepal.
But in any event, Buddha was tuned into the radical language.
Oh, unquestionably. Now, in other instances, the dialogue with trees might be based more directly in survival needs, the tree offering shelter and sustenance, and human communities offering some measure of protection to the trees in return. And this is regularly recorded in literature. My favorite poem, from Wordsworth at least, dates from 1803, and it's about the yew in Lorton. There is a yew, the pride of Lorton's Vale, which to this day stands single in the midst of its own darkness as it stood of yore. Of vast circumference and gloom profound, this solitary tree, a living thing, produced too slowly ever to decay, of form and aspect too magnificent to be destroyed.
Oh, that's really lovely.
Yes, I've long wanted to travel to Lorton to see what's become of this tree. On the other hand, there's the so-called Boscobel oak that offered sanctuary to Charles II in his escape from the Cromwellians. And this tree was quite literally dismembered, torn limb from limb by those wanting a special keepsake. And the tree was dead by the end of the 19th century.
You refer to the many literary traditions that really animate tree roots.
Yes, there's a mountain of that material. It really is, it's its own separate literary genre. I guess my favorite is this unabashedly romantic passage from Nathaniel Lee's Oedipus. Nor tree grows here, but what is fed with magic juice, all full of human souls that cleave their barks to dance at midnight by the moon's pale beams.
Very nice. I notice that many of your citations are from English sources. Were you educated in England, or?
No, I spent a little bit of time at Oxford when I was at university here in the States, but the fact is I'm just terribly fond of England. The people appreciate their trees quite profoundly for the most part, and it's one of the few places where I have felt the presence of truly kindred spirits. When I give presentations, the responses Well, it's always very polite, but sometimes it's even quite enthusiastic.
All right. Towards the end of your report, you seem to hint at the existence of something resembling a collective arboreal intelligence.
Well, I began thinking of it as a really more as a metaphor. It's hard to look at photographs or visual extrapolated representations of one sort or another of the vast intertwining root systems beneath the ground of the great forest without conjuring up a comparable image of the tangled neurons of the human brain. But as I've spent more and more time in the last vestiges of the primeval forest around the world, I've begun to at least entertain the idea that there may in fact be something resembling a sort of a green brain that would account for the sense of not being alone amongst the redwoods and the larches. Once you tune into it, it's really quite a moving experience, and it needs to be reckoned with and accounted for.
You even speculate that this green brain may be fired by cosmic radiation.
Yes, well, I am certainly not an astrophysicist, but it has occurred to me that trees may in some way be acting as receptors or filters or mediators, really, for the ubiquitous microwave radiation produced by the Big Bang approximately 15 billion years ago, and that this intermediary role may account for the innumerable creation myths around the world that associate the voice of God, the location of the voice of God, with the presence or predominance of great trees.
So massive deforestation not just eliminates a natural resource, but actually terminates intelligence.
I doubt I could put it better myself. Perhaps you want to join me on some of these lecture tours.
No thanks, but I am really struck by your consistent willingness to take literary motifs as grounded in science.
Yes, well, ever since the story of the German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann, who was digging for years to uncover the ruins of Troy and was ridiculed for many years for having fallen prey to the fevered imagination of some primitive author named Homer. And then, of course, he discovered it. And surely since then, we should keep at least one ear open to the possibility that ancient imaginations, as captured in some of these sublime texts, may indeed point the way to some critical or central scientific discovery.